Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Pour your heart out.
You are known as the bald priestess.
Yes, but people are saying, I don't remember her name. They can say, yeah, she's the bald one and you find me. I don't want it to become a capitalist transactional piece where you pay somebody money and they say some fancy words and off they go.
One wedding trend that you would happily just ban forever.
Donut walls. It'd be really important to do it as Claire, who you were as a child, rather than Claire Byrne, the broadcaster.
Never have I ever.
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 Wedding season is in full swing again. Every second weekend, someone's off to a hotel in Clare or they're standing in the freezing cold in Wicklow. Afraid to say that they're freezing cold because it really is worth it for the photographs. It's always worth it for the photographs. If you're Irish, chances are you've probably spent a fair chunk of your life both at weddings and at funerals. But here's the thing I've been thinking about. Like, despite all the ceremonies I have been at, nobody has ever asked me to officiate at one of them. You know, like in an unofficial capacity. Like, none of my friends have ever gone, surely Claire would be good at that. I'm not taking it personally, but almost. I got married myself in the Dublin Registry Office 10 years ago, exactly this year. And after all of these years of attending weddings and funerals and christenings and so on, never have I ever stood at the front and led one. But I am joined by somebody who has done that, because I'm joined by Karen Dempsey. Karen, you're very welcome.
Hi, Claire.
So when you say to people that you are a celebrant,
yeah,
what do you think that they think? What do they say to you about that job?
I think immediately people go into how they would feel about that job. So they either say something like, I'd love to do that. That sounds brilliant. I've always thought about doing it. Or I could never do that. I could never stand in front of people and speak publicly. Mm-hmm. People are rarely kind of mediocre about it. There's some kind of interest somewhere.
They have strong feelings about it.
Yeah, they do tend to, yeah. To me, the ceremony sets the tone for the day. And that's why I think it's so meaningful as well, to kind of create that feeling of community and connection in the ceremony. Because then people will carry that forward into the celebrations afterwards and onwards into the life of that couple.
So then when it came to, let's say, your first wedding, did you have that moment where you thought, right, I am leading the charge. This is me now. This day depends on very much what I do.
So my first wedding ceremony was two people who I didn't know at the time and went on to become dear friends of mine, Renee and Audrey. Yeah, on the day of their wedding ceremony, I remember that morning, they messaged and said, oh, Karen, we don't have ribbons for such and such. Could you pick up something? I was like,
this is not part of the job.
Yeah, I was like, I'm already on my like last minute to, but I laughed and I just stopped on the way down, got the ribbons. And that's very much a part of it as well. I'm really, really strong with couples in saying nothing can go wrong. And whatever happens is part of the story. I mean, whether we have ribbons or not is actually irrelevant.
Uh-huh. Karen Dempsey isn't just somebody who conducts weddings. Before becoming a celebrant, she worked as a nurse, a psychotherapist, a flight attendant, and in pharmaceutical sales. She grew up in a family marked by sudden loss, trained in interfaith ministry, and founded Entheos, an organisation that supports people who feel somewhere in between faith and no faith. These days, she spends her time helping people through some of life's biggest moments, weddings, funerals, and even deathbed ceremonies, which is why she's the perfect person to talk to here on Never Have I Ever. Over the years, as part of my job as a journalist and a broadcaster, I've spoken to many people on some of the darkest days of their lives. But Karen's job isn't to tell those stories. It's to stand in the middle of them, to help families through moments most of us would struggle to imagine. And when I think about the funerals, the deathbed weddings, the ceremonies for babies and children, that's the moment I wonder whether I could ever do what she does. What we expect and what we want from ceremonies, and let's focus on weddings for a moment, has changed a lot. Like, do you see that, say, in the last 10 years or so?
Yes. That first wedding ceremony was in 2016 that I held. We're becoming a lot more comfortable with being invited to a wedding that's not in a church, where people usually would have expected to be going to a church of some faith path in Ireland, generally Catholic. It's actually really becoming unusual to go to a church, really, in my friends and colleagues. I think couples as well are becoming a lot more comfortable in knowing what it is that they want from their ceremony too. Mm-hmm. They will have all gone to their own friends and colleagues' ceremonies. They'll have seen things. And I'll often ask couples that as well. What do you know for sure that you either do or don't want in your ceremony? And we can start from there and build, because that gives me a good sense of where they're at. Because some might say, I saw this at my friend's wedding ceremony and hated it. And it could be something that some couples absolutely love. But if it's not for them, it's not for them. End of story.
They can really create whatever they want, which is the joy of it.
Yes, that is also the burden of it. So this is a piece that I'm really firm on. I don't sit down with a couple and say, you can have whatever you like. Because that is so overwhelming. They don't really know where to start. So my role is to sit down with them and say, what is it that you do know about this? What are you envisioning? What is the kind of vibe that you want? And they need to say only a very little for me to have a sense of where they're going. And then I will talk them through the outline framework that I generally use. And that really helps reassure them that they don't have to make a million decisions. They don't have to come up with it all. Actually, most of the couples who come to me as well are busy couples, busy professionals, and they're raising kids, and they're really, really busy, and they don't have time to spend hours sitting down planning this massive big ceremony. But what we want is, when we do hold the ceremony, that both of them and their families and their communities go, oh, wow, this is just perfect for them.
I'm surprised to see you say that, because you've described yourself as the most unromantic celebrant.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I thought, is that not illegal in this profession to be unromantic at weddings?
Yeah, to me, I'm really passionate about that, because I think we are risking over-romanticising ceremonies and weddings. Weddings in particular, because the one thing that I think with a wedding is, yes, the ceremony is this beautiful day that has lots of planning into it, but the marriage is something that the couple are stepping into wholeheartedly. They know that they don't know what's ahead. But what they do know is that regardless of what's to come, this is the person they want by their side, come what may.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is deeply profound. And it can get lost in the over-romanticising sometimes of, there's lovely stories about how couples met and how they got engaged. But all of that in the grand scheme of things boils down to, they met each other somehow, crossed paths, decided this person is interesting enough to move on to meet them the next time. And the series of all those yeses lead them to a space where they say, we are going to commit to one another. I don't believe in the till death do us part unless the couple use that language themselves. Because I really think that the power of a marriage is in the choice with which the couple choose one another, and the choice with which every day they decide, yes, I am in this marriage because I want to be.
So you don't need to pour sugar over that, is what you're saying.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So you take it as it is on that day, rather than sort of trying to project a love story onto that couple.
Yes. Yes. And I think the love story is a big thing that is coming out in a lot of wedding ceremonies. A lot of them do incorporate a love story. But I don't necessarily incorporate the love story because I don't go seeking it. I use what the couple tell me. And to me, the power of a marriage ceremony is the ancientness of it. It's not that, you know, there's a word bespoke that is bandied around a lot with weddings. This is a bespoke ceremony, bespoke this, bespoke that. To me, for the ceremony, it should be recognisable to everybody that's there as this ancient tradition of two people choosing one another for whatever reason they're choosing one another. And I won't even presume it's love, you know, some form of love or some form of commitment and togetherness that they're choosing. We have done that since the dawn of time. And it hasn't always been allowed. Like, there's always been people who have maybe wanted to pledge a love and commitment to one another and haven't been allowed by the communities that they're in. And that still persists now. But regardless of approval, people have always found a way to find their person and be with their person. So to me, that's what I'm really wanting to tap into for that couple, to really bed it in for them, the beauty and the profundity of what they're doing, but also for their community, that their community is moving from, like, there may be people who maybe know one spouse better or the other spouse better. Through the ceremony, they're all meeting each other and they're getting to see each person in a different light to what they usually do. And they're also getting the gift of this beautiful insight into the inner world of this couple. Because most people don't see them in their inner world as a couple. They don't know how they actually feel about one another or what it is that they believe their marriage will bring to them. Mm-hmm. But through the language of the ceremony and through the vows that they pledge to one another, and through how they represent their union, everybody there gets to know them in a different light.
So what happens if you have a couple who want pink candy floss, confetti shaped out of love hearts and an 80s power ballad? Are you okay with that?
100%. Yes, I am okay with whatever the couple wants. Once there is meaning to it. Once we can find the gravitas as well. I mean, I can't even imagine this situation really, but if it seems like this is just a performance and there's no gravitas to it at all, I would suggest that maybe I'm not the celebrant for them.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever said, this is not for me?
No, I don't think I've ever fully. Oh, well, Entheos is the organisation I run. As an organisation, we have made a statement that we will not hold weddings in Doonbeg, Trump's hotel, because Trump's worldview flies in the face of the values of our organisation. I have said no to ceremonies in Doonbeg. Mm-hmm. And part of why this organisation made the statement was because I realised then, oh, if I'm going to say no because of my own value system, I don't feel right passing that ceremony on to somebody else because they then have to make a decision. So that's what made the bigger statement. And actually, I was really proud to make that big statement as well, because to me, it's really important. Donald Trump is not just a hotel owner. You know, he's a global influential figure. So for our little organisation in Ireland to be authentic to our values, that's part of what we'll do. So yes, so those kind of things I would have said no.
And that is a big policy decision that you have made. But when it comes to the personal, you've never looked at a couple, for example, and said, do you know what? This just doesn't feel like something that I want to be involved in.
Yeah. So the one that actually comes to mind on that as well is I will say no to surprise ceremonies or surprise vow renewals in particular, because I really think, how can you have a vow renewal by surprise? Like, how can one person decide, I'm sure my spouse wants to renew their vows. And even if the spouse does really want to renew their vows, I think it's doing them a disservice if you don't allow them time and space to reflect on what it is they would like to vow at this point in their life, because it's probably not going to be exactly the same as what they would have vowed at the very beginning of their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of thing.
I think that makes sense, because it almost sounds unfair, doesn't it?
When you think about it.
One party to not allow them some time to absorb what they're going to do, because it is serious and it is important and you should be allowed to reflect on it.
Yes. And you should even be able to decide what you're wearing on the day. And very often it's couples travelling to Ireland. And one thinks, wouldn't it be great if we're in Stephen's Green and this celebrant pops up and does a surprise vow renew?
No, it's not. Because I want to get nice clothes on and get things ready.
And think about what we're doing and really make it meaningful for both parties. Mm-hmm. Then it's powerful. Otherwise, it's just, oh my God, what happened there?
So listen, because I have never done this, I want to know what it's like. What is that feeling like to stand at the top of the room and to know you're holding this together emotionally for the room, or you're setting the tone emotionally for this really important day for these people?
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. And I think a lot of what I love about it is I love people. So I love to feel and read what is going on in the room, because the pattern it will follow is when you go in first and everybody's arriving, it's really jingle jangle. And very often you'll have one spouse in the room while the other is off getting ready. And they will have everybody coming up and saying, oh, are they going to show up? Are you nervous? And I really feel for them, because I think, oh, all that's doing is actually escalating any nerves that are there, or else they're trying to be super cool and unfazed. And I'll often say to that person, do you want to just take a breather and step outside, or, you know, do what you need to do to keep yourself nice and level? Then you have the part where everybody's taking their seats and people are seeing one another. And again, it's all that fizziness. The usual format is that one party is in and then the other party walks up the aisle or is escorted. But couples can do it however they like. So when we get to that point, I will step outside and greet whoever is coming in as well, because very often they too are full of all the preparations and this is about to happen, and like that feeling of overwhelm. So to me, it's very much about taking a deep breath. Feel your feet. You're here. Nothing can go wrong. We're going to do this. And I'll say to both of them as well, you don't have to remember anything. I'll guide you the whole way through. So you just breathe, be present with one another and enjoy.
You are excited, but you're calm.
Calm is a superpower.
Well, it has to be your superpower, I take it, from what you're saying, because everybody else is, you know, 10 feet off the ground with nerves and excitement and all of the rest. Yeah. So you have to be calm.
Absolutely. And even if something has happened to throw me, I have to be calm. And there's no point in having a celebrant who's full of the, oh, stage management and direct that and all that. You can do all that, but you have to be calm. And you have to be ready to go when it's time to go. You have to be ready to just begin and to roll with what's happening. And I mean, I've had ceremonies where it's outdoor. And I mean, I remember one couple from Arizona, the hotel and I all tried to tell them Irish weather is changeable. They didn't get it. We were standing outside a castle and there was a beautiful wide horizon and I could see the clouds coming, literally. And it's on my social media, actually, because the clouds came and there was an absolute downpour. And I just had to make a decision there and then. I mean, the couple really wanted to go for it and they knew it might rain. All I could do was really condense down my words because there's no point breaking the ceremony right in the middle. So we got to the exchange of vows, joining of hands, exchange of vows and rings, did the pronouncement, ran inside and then did the pieces that we couldn't do. You know, the poems and readings and all that. I just saved all of them, did the core bit and then we ran in. And it's beautiful. It just, it is what it is. Everybody got saturated. What could you do?
I want to talk to you about when the weddings and the funerals become one almost. And I know that you have performed wedding ceremonies when people are in their last hours.
Yeah.
What is that like?
It is very intense because it is incredibly intense to know that time becomes suddenly so powerful and important. And the ceremonies that happen at end of life, it's not always that the clock is ticking on you, but sometimes it really, really is. And my background in hospice nursing actually really helps me with that because I know that even if people say, I think it's fine and I think they'll be grand or we're planning to do this tomorrow, I will say, you need to be ready to do it with very short notice. And I say to them as well, you just call me. I will come day or night. And I make space when I'm holding a space for a family like this. I make space. I will come day or night. There is no problem. And I'm very familiar with hospitals and hospital wards and how it works. So it's incredibly intense. And it is incredibly humbling as well. I think sometimes people think, and you see it maybe on social media and on the television, where there is a ceremony happening in a hospital and there's this big rush to get a dress and to get a bouquet and to get all of these things. And amazing if we have the space for that. But if we don't, actually, it's so profound to have two people who, when the clock is bearing down on you, very often it's because of the legals. So it's not that it's a symbolic ceremony in that case. It's that we want to get the legal part complete. And a part of that is the couple must commit to one another and exchange vows. And those vows are incredibly pared back and simple because usually a couple is talking about the rest of their life and all that's ahead of them. And this couple knows, they know what's ahead. And they know that they are still here, hand in hand, pledging their love and commitment to one another in marriage.
Is there still joy in those situations?
Yes, there is a profound joy and relief in getting the couple to this part that they want. And there is a joy in them completing this cycle of the relationship together, because that means that the spouse who is left behind can call the other person their husband, wife, spouse. And socially, we cannot underestimate the power of that in the social contract and in legacy and in how they go on to speak about their person from there on, because people really understand the profound loss of a partner. But even how it's recognised when the person, when there's a marriage, is very different. So that's really, really important.
And I know you've said that you try to take up as little space as possible in those situations. So is that very different to other types of ceremonies that you would do?
Yeah, in other types of ceremonies, I will always make space for the voices of the people at the centre of the ceremony and their people. So if it's a funeral, if there's going to be a eulogy and poems read, again, if we're on a tight schedule, I will always make sure that those voices have most of the space. And then I'm setting the intention, welcoming people, grounding them in, create space for all those voices, and then having a solid close. A solid beginning and a solid ending are really important in ceremony, because otherwise people are ungrounded. So that's the space that I take. In an end-of-life wedding, I mean, you could have the risk of feeling like there should be some profound words shared or some poems, or all of that is beautiful, but actually irrelevant, really. The profound piece is the couple marrying one another, and they marry one another. I don't marry them. I think that's really important for them even to feel empowered too. And the other thing is, very often one spouse, the one who's dying, very often doesn't have a lot of breath. We have to remember that, you know, we can't ask them to pledge a big vow or to say big words. Very often, I do is as much as they can say. So I want to take as little space, even when you're in, like, the room is so small. And if a person is struggling to breathe, you can't even take up space in the room, air in the room. It's as literal as that. It can feel a bit patronizing as well when everybody's going, oh, yay. The sense is reverence and honoring and gratitude that we can do this,
mm-hmm.
and space for them to process together. And that's it.
Do you think we're getting better at talking about death in Ireland?
There are layers to that. Yes, in some ways we're getting much better about talking about death in Ireland. We risk losing some of the organicness of how we approach death, but I think that's still there once we just are conscious of maintaining it. I one time was holding a funeral and the curtains closed and there was the most enormous spider on the curtains behind me. And I named it as the curtains closed. Thankfully, I'm not afraid of spiders. And afterwards, one of the grandchildren said to me that their granny adored spiders, but thought it was the funniest thing to put fake spiders around and scare people.
Ah, brilliant.
So like, yeah, you get these gorgeous, meaningful things that come out.
Part of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think people are more honest at funerals or at weddings?
Probably funerals. Depends. I think sometimes we can put too much emphasis on the happiness. This is all good and happy in a wedding. And I think it's really important to hold that weddings often come with grief as well, particularly when somebody has died, whether it's been recent or very old, that grief is there. And people can sometimes be afraid in case it's going to come out and overwhelm the ceremony. And I will always say, it won't overwhelm anything. We need a space for it. If there's a space for that grief, that will allow you to process it in real time and then also be present for the celebratory parts too.
To acknowledge it is
important. Acknowledge it, yeah, yeah. Pushing it down never really helps.
This is Never Have I Ever, and celebrant Karen Dempsey from Entheos Ireland is with me this week. Now, Karen, I have rapid fire questions for you. I'm looking forward to this bit. So we're going to do some myth busting. You ready?
Yep.
These kinds of ceremonies that you do are just for hippies. True or false?
False.
Have you ever looked at a couple and thought, this is a bad idea?
Once or twice.
Have you been right?
No, I was wrong, actually. Yeah.
That's good to know. Is there one wedding trend that you would happily just ban forever?
Donut walls in the summertime.
Because they attract things?
They attract wasps.
That's a very sensible reason. What's the one thing that people always think will matter on the day, but it never does?
Oh, the trimmings. It doesn't matter. People stress so much about the candles and the ribbons and the
sweet carts. And all
sweet
that
cart, yeah. Once you have your two people, everybody else is a bonus. Everything else is a bonus.
What's more stressful for you, a wedding or a funeral?
A wedding.
Do Irish people love a good funeral?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm glad you're honest about that. What about the most Irish thing that happens at funerals?
God, there's so many things. The breaking into song. and the finding of meaning in tiny things.
Is it possible to have a genuinely funny funeral?
Yes, it is. People sometimes want that in a funeral, but I will say we have to remember that it's always deeply sad as well. So very often it comes from the dying person who say, I don't want any of you crying at my funeral. I want you to have great crack. And families will go to great lengths to do that. But I remind them that it's okay, that the sadness is going to be there anyway, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's okay too. And sometimes that even is enough of a relief for them to be able then to move into the celebratory piece.
Entheos, your organisation. So you set it up to exist in that place between God and people who are not interested in believing in God. Tell me about finding that space or why you thought the gap was there that needed to be filled.
So my background is nursing. I was originally a nurse and I did hospice home care. So I would go and sit with people for the last 7 nights of their life. And a lot of that involved speaking to people in the lead up to their death and also their families and how they were navigating death and dying. Simultaneously, I was also working in the rotunda, which was around births. And sometimes a death will come before birth. Maternity hospitals are really complex places because you have birth and death happening. Thankfully, fewer deaths. And I don't want to alarm anybody that's ever listening. But it's a fact of life. And we all know it in various ways. So I was speaking to people about their beliefs and around life and death. And particularly in the rotunda, it tended to be a younger demographic because it was women of childbearing age. And there was one particular woman I spoke to at like the wee hours of the morning, 3 or 4 a.m. She was miscarrying and she was trying to rationalize how she was understanding this. And she said, "Karen, I didn't think I believed in God, but I don't know where my baby is. What do you believe?" And when she said to me, "What do you believe?" I thought, oh, I really empathized with what she said because I was kind of similar. I was like, I believe in something more, but I'm not quite sure what.
Mm-hmm.
So that sent me on a path. At that point, I was already almost finished a master's in psychotherapy. And it was psychosynthesis psychotherapy, which is a spiritual psychotherapy. But I went from there onwards to do a 2-year training in London with the One Spirit Interfaith Foundation, seeking answers to my questions. And I came out the other side of that and went, I still have questions. I still don't actually have the answer. But I was much more comfortable with my not knowing at that point. When I set up Entheos, it was particularly around the Irish context, because that was a training in the UK, which is about various faith paths. And I realised that for me and for my contemporaries, it's not so much about the faith paths. It's about when you step outside of a faith path and still hold some of that core belief and tradition in your bones, but you don't really have anywhere to put it. And I felt like in Ireland, we were at risk of really overly polarising that from all these faith paths to atheism, humanism, where there's no belief in something more. And there was this really beautiful middle ground that nothing was really happening in. Some things were happening in, but I saw ways from my previous work. I saw ways of making sure that we kept community at the heart of ceremony and ceremony at the heart of community. Because I didn't want to just set up an organization that holds ceremonies. I wanted it to be in service to the wider community somehow.
So you're essentially, you're allowing for the possibility of God. You're not
absolutely
throwing the baby out with the bathwater, yeah, when it comes to Catholic Ireland and everything that went with our faith, which was community,
yes,
ceremony.
That's the beauty of it. Yeah.
All of that.
Community, tradition, the generational aspects, the like of the rosary. I would very often hold ceremonies now where we would incorporate a rosary. And it may be a person who has for a long time been away from the traditional faith path, hasn't attended mass within the institutional church, but they very much maintain those things.
Mm-hmm. What does it for you spiritually?
Stillness does it for me spiritually, and nature. Being able to find my stillness and also being able to connect with people. And I do that best from a place of stillness, I think. It's about being able to be with the most simple aspects of life. Being able to be in my own company. And my spiritual practice is challenging myself to see the best in other people. And that can be deeply challenging. Or even not the best, challenging myself to see the good in people as well. I'm very involved in activism. And activism can be quite polarizing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in order for activism to really have the depth of purpose that it needs to have, we need to be able to hold polarities and we need to be able to find some kind of human connection so that we don't just write each other off and, mm-hmm, you know, dismiss each other totally.
I know that you work a lot with LGBTQ plus couples who still feel connected to their faith, but often excluded to a,
yeah,
certain extent.
Yeah.
What have you learned about those conversations? Because a lot of people, not necessarily people from those groups, but I think all sorts of people in Ireland from younger generations feel that way. Part of something, but maybe not welcome.
Yeah. This was a really key part for me as well in creating Entheos, because when I mentioned it being polarized between, you know, faith paths and no faith or no God, there were people in between who deeply have a deep faith in God, but were not able to practice that within the faith path of their, mm-hmm, choice. And I thought they were the people that I most wanted to create a space for, because they were being the most underserved. I had two women who came over from Scotland, one of my early ceremonies. They were women of profoundly deep faith. And they created their ceremony very much themselves because they knew all the aspects they wanted to incorporate. And they were really devastated that they were unable to celebrate their union and their marriage and their love within the Catholic Church. We also have survivors of institutional abuse, mothers and children from mother and baby homes and institutional homes. I don't even like calling them mother and baby homes because it was so painful. we've also just got the social witnessing of such deep and profound traumas and the generational impacts of that. So all of those people, I wanted to create a space where they could bring what they were connected to so that that could be expressed mm-hmm. through ceremony or through whatever kind of participatory spirituality they might
like. I think there must be a great comfort for those people in knowing that somebody understands the connection.
Yeah.
Like, despite the fact that maybe you don't feel welcome in this place or you have been hurt by this place, I understand you're saying to them that you have a deep connection yeah. that you can't disown.
Absolutely.
There's yeah. a comfort in yeah. that, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think the reverence for the essence of the faith path is really important. To me, I have a deep reverence for the essence of all faith paths.
Mm-hmm.
The institutional aspects, I don't have a reverence for that. I just would straight up say I don't have a reverence for any hierarchy or anything that tells me that I need an intermediary between me and the God of my understanding. And that's me. Other people have a deep reverence for that, and that's fine for them too. But the people that are coming, say, to me or to Entheos seeking a ceremony, in general, they're not seeking a priest usually, because they can access a priest through the faith path, unless they are somebody who has been ostracized actively by that faith
yes.
path and they can't have a priest for their wedding.
Just when you mentioned the word priest, you are known as the bald priestess,
yeah.
aren't you? How do you feel about that?
It's a funny one, actually, because it's of old. I didn't really overthink it. Yeah, perfect. I mean, to me, I'm hopefully one of the most recognizable celebrants doing the rounds. So if people are saying, oh, I don't remember her name, they can say, yeah, she's the bald one and you find me. But the word priestess is a funny one because I don't really like the word priest because it implies hierarchy or separation. So I probably wouldn't choose it again, but it's there and it's established. So
it's,
yeah.
It's become a thing.
Yeah. And it's also a kind of a reclamation as well because
and
it has the S on the end.
Can I talk to you about the alopecia for
yes.
a moment? Because does that change how you feel you present yourself to the world when you're standing at the top of that room? Has it changed you in any way?
Yeah, I think it definitely has changed me in ways that I probably won't ever really fully know. I think before I had alopecia, I had full head of lovely, shiny, dark hair. And I used to be an Aer Lingus cabin crew. So, you know, our hair was the updos were all a big fancy thing. And I used to love a good updo. But I had all the privileges that came with that, you know, of at the time, I mean, I was in my 20s when I got alopecia. So I had youth. I was standardly good looking, I suppose. I said that with the typical Irish, like, oh, I can't really say that about myself.
Young, beautiful, gorgeous,
I had all
long,
that,
dark
all the
hair.
Trappings of it, yeah. And then when your hair falls out, it is incredibly hard to explain how profound the change is. Because when I passed a mirror then and looked at myself, I just didn't recognise myself. And I had freckles, I've always had freckles. My skin was so white from my scalp back. And it's a really, really deeply profound adjustment when all your hair falls out. So I had bought a wig and I remember it was so expensive. It was like 795 euros at the time, which was insane money. And I put it on a credit card and I bought it because I felt like I should. And I felt like I should have a wig and I should. I'd say I wore it about twice.
Did you not bother after that?
I just felt like I was in disguise.
Hmm. But now, I mean, do people talk to you about it? Is it one of the things that people who meet you first will say or do they not say it?
Not anymore, funny enough. Probably, I suppose, because it's old news now in some ways. You very often get the child saying, Mammy, why is that lady got no hair? And I feel for parents because you can tell they're like, oh my God, make them stop. So I just kind of smile and go on. But no, for the most part, people don't really mention it too much. And it's funny because I forget that I'm bald. So I'm looking at people and totally forgetting that I don't have hair in my head. And there's times when I might say something like silly, like, I met such and such a person, I don't know how they recognise me. And it could be my son or someone going, Mom, you're bald. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that bit.
You've had lots of careers, Karen.
Yes.
Like, you've mentioned that you were a nurse and you were an air hostess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were a pharmaceutical rep. You
yep.
did your psychotherapy training as
yep.
well. I mean, looking back at all of those things now, do you think that they were in preparation for what you're doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember somebody once saying that life only makes sense in hindsight. And that really made sense to me. I mean, when I did my nursing and then I went back to UCD and I did an arts degree in English, Irish and psychology. I remember being like, Irish, what's that got to do with anything? And now the language is such an important part of my ceremonial work, because even if the ceremony isn't in Irish, it informs the landscape of how I'm approaching the ceremony. There's a really deep connection between Irish people. Even if we've always spoken English all our lives, the language is in our bones and it comes out how we speak and in the turn of phrase we use.
Mm-hmm.
And I will nearly always incorporate the landscape as well within a ceremony. Like where we are standing is meaningful. No matter where it is, the land we stand on when we make a commitment to one another is important and profound as well.
So everything that you've done up to this point has informed what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely way to look at a varied career.
Yeah.
You know, that it all helps ground you in what you're currently doing.
Yes. Some aspect of each one of those roles and careers drew a part of my personality. Mm-hmm. So it helped me develop different parts of my personality to a more rounded place now.
So like, I'm just thinking about your life as palliative care nurse and then doing these deathbed weddings and also funerals. I mean, does it change your view of your life, your death? Does it inform how you live?
There's two ways of looking at this. I really do think I live my life as full as I can today. End of story. Mm-hmm. Because I know tomorrow is not promised to me. I also don't let that be tyrannical, like the tyranny of you might die tomorrow. You know, like some people say, oh, tell everybody you love them and because you might die tomorrow. Like, that's not real either. We have to have authentic relationships. You know, as long as I'm real and authentic every day, that's my main thing. I also, if I'm doing something that involves risk, I'm like hyper aware that this risk may not go the way that I want it to, because I'm holding ceremonies so often in situations that you hear stories and I go, oh, like that is unthinkable that happened and that's how that person died. And when you're in a position where you're repeatedly hearing this, most people would only hear one of them every so often, you know, out there in society. When you're hearing them all the time,
you're exposed to it a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
And I hold funerals for people and they really stay with me as well. And the nature that they died. And I'm like, I'll give you an example. I held a funeral a few years ago for, people will remember it, a beautiful delivery driver who died during the height of COVID, was killed in an accident. And now every time I order food and it is delivered by a courier on a bike, I am grateful to that courier. Because they are at risk all the time. They're out, and people give out about them scooting between cars and all, but they're doing that to get people their food to them, and they're risking their actual lives. It just kind of gives me a different perspective on how I see things.
Mm-hmm.
And all the people who do various types of work that involve them putting themselves at risk every day, people are amazing and they absolutely fascinate me. And I just love to see people in their zone of genius and their area of expertise, and however complex or simple that might be.
I know I'm asking, you know, should I do this? Should I consider doing something like this, right? This is the whole point of this. But when I listen to you talking about officiating at funerals, I don't know how I would get through the sadness of it.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that?
That's a big question. The big question there that I hear is, you don't know how you would cope with it.
I know I wouldn't. Like, I would find it too traumatic.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful awareness. So first of all, that's really important, because I will never say, no, you wouldn't, plough on through it. That's your number one awareness. The second part is, if you were to say, I don't know how I'd do it, I feel like I would get really emotional, upset, but I really want to do it. If you wanted to, that's the next piece, because I hold trainings for celebrants and a huge part of the training is learning to be with big emotions. And that goes for weddings and funerals, because we don't do a wedding ceremony training and a funeral ceremony training. I don't do that because I don't believe they're as different as people think. Both of them contain big emotions. So a lot of the training is getting used to your own big emotions, bringing them to the surface and seeing how you deal with them. And people are usually really surprised at themselves when they do that. Because if you want to do it, you'll find a place in yourself that is still and solid. The other part is, when I'm holding ceremony, I am nearly always emotional. And I think that's the beauty and that keeps the freshness in my ceremonies, because I let myself be moved by people. I believe it is my job to be moved by what I see and feel in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to music concerts and I cry at movies and I let myself feel all those emotions. That is part of my work and is the part of the work of every celebrant. So if I'm holding a funeral ceremony, one of the things that often really gets me is children or grandchildren crying at the loss of a parent or a grandparent. That I just find so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And I name it. So if I'm holding a ceremony and maybe there's been a beautiful slideshow or like a grandchild has sung a song, I will say, I am so moved by that. I need a moment to compose myself, and I'm sure, I know I'm not alone.
And you don't feel guilt at expressing the emotion, because it's not your day and it's not your grief. So sometimes I think when we cry because we hear something sad, I think, well, I'm going to be living my normal life tomorrow. Yeah. The family of this person are going to hold this grief for a very long time. So it's not mine.
Yeah,
but I hear you. But you don't feel that.
If I felt that I would go to pieces at the microphone, that's different. There have been days, I might get a phone call for a funeral and I say, I actually can't take it today. I'm not in the space. And I would always say to every celebrant, you do not have to take every ceremony that crosses your path. Or when I just had Roisin, actually, she's 7 now. She was only a few weeks old and I got a call for a baby funeral because I hold a lot of baby funerals. And I said, I couldn't, I'm not in the space for doing that. So I didn't. So I'll never let it overwhelm me. But I think it adds to the authenticity and the connection when we let ourselves be moved, because otherwise it's not an acting role. There is a type of celebrancy which is more public speaking. You know, you can buy a thing online and you go. And actually, I say that as well. Anybody can hold any ceremony, not the legal part in Ireland. Not the legal wedding ceremony, but anybody can hold a funeral ceremony or a wedding ceremony or a baby welcoming or anything like that. So you do not need formal training, but there's a big difference in the quality of it when you're a person who has reflected deeply on what you're doing and why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if somebody was listening to this and they feel stuck or they feel like they're disconnected in a way and they're listening to you and going, maybe that is where I should be, where would you start if you were interested in pursuing what you do?
I think the place to start is a bit of space for yourself. I think very often we can go straight in our head and start trying to figure it out, the pros and cons of everything. I always encourage people to give a bit of space and time to reflecting on what did you love as a child? What drew you as a child? What were you like? What way was your personality inclined before the world started pointing you in different directions or telling you that's a good part of you, that's a bad part of you?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can go back to the core of yourself, it will help move it forward for you. I think as well, people that are drawn to ceremonial work, self-awareness is the absolute key piece. So if you're drawn to the work, getting yourself into some kind of therapy, I think, is a really good step to get to know yourself a bit better. And also, if people are drawn towards celebrancy, part of it is sometimes people kind of see it as a business in a box kind of thing. That's a job that I could do and earn money and sure, it's great, it's super happy all the time. And I really caution people against that. You can do it, but I want to protect ceremonial work in this country. I don't want it to become a capitalist transactional piece where you pay somebody money and they say some fancy words and off they go. And that becomes elitist as well. I would love people to connect to why they want to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
What is it you want to bring to the world? What is it that you would like to see more in the world? Like, what's the change you would like to see in the world? And how can you help bring that about? And I think that part, protecting ceremony from capitalism, is really important to me. And that's why we have the baby funerals and the end of life weddings. The income we generate through the hotel weddings funds those ceremonies. And to me, that is really important because otherwise there's not much point in Entheos existing as an organization if we're just kind of doing the same thing that other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're serving a space that is underserved and it's really beautiful and powerful and I love it.
So what do you think I should do? Should I keep being the guest at the weddings and the funerals or should I step up now and become the celebrant?
Well, honestly, the work that you do in the world, you connect deeply with people. And I can almost see emotion in you as I say this, but it's really important. You have that skill. Radio, television, podcasts create communities. So if you were to do it, I think it would be really important to do it as Claire, who you were as a child, rather than Claire Byrne, the broadcaster. Because the broadcaster could slip you into a part of you that takes you away from the underserved part that maybe has a lot to bring.
That's fascinating, Karen. And it's been so lovely to talk to you.
Oh, you too.
Thank you very much, Karen Dempsey, for being here on Never Have I Ever.
Thank you, Claire.
You've been listening to Never Have I Ever with me, Claire Byrne. You'll find a new episode every Wednesday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you stream your content. Please be sure to like and follow the podcast or leave a review. You can also email me at any time. The address is never@newstalk.com. Never Have I Ever is a weekly podcast from Newstalk. The producer is Tom Donnelly. And don't forget, you'll find The Claire Byrne Show every weekday morning from 9, live on News Talk Radio and streaming on the Go Loud app.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne. a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Conversation uncorked.